Welcome to the Sourdough Speak, the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services, in cooperation with Alaska Communication Arts, brings you this series of discussions about the history and development of the Great Valleys of Interior Alaska, the Yukon, and the Tanana, and the city of Fairbanks, which developed with the coming of miners during the Great Gold Stampede at the turn of the century. In this series, the Sourdough Speak, pioneer Alaskans tell you their stories about their lives as they saw and played a part in the unfolding story of Alaskan growth. Now here is your host for this series, Neville Jacobs.
Sam O. White was 30 when he left Maine to come to Alaska in 1922 to work for the United States Coast and Geodetic Survey. A few years later, the USC and GS transferred Sam outside, and shortly after, he made up his mind. The North Country was home, and he was going back. He returned to Alaska as a federal game agent, then became one of Alaska's early bush pirates. Sam has written about his Alaskan experiences. The series was published in the Alaska Sportsman magazine, and he has been the subject of many articles. You'd think that most of Sam's stories had been told, but today's interview goes back to that period when he first came north for the Coast and Geodetic Survey in 1924 and 1925. At that time, Sam explored a country previously unsurveyed. He went in as a reconnaissance man, making a preliminary survey. Sam established routes, trails, campsites, and base surveys. He traveled on foot from Fairbanks to Eagle, down the Yukon to Circle City, and back to Fairbanks. This is not about Sam, it is Sam. We visited Sam at his home in Fairbanks, where photograph albums peek from beneath couches and tables, and mementos of past experiences line the walls. Sam is a big man, and he fills his oak and leather chair. As he talks, moving forward for emphasis, leaning back to relax, his big chair creaks and squeaks, and speaks with him. As you listen, you'll know you're in the home of Sam White, and you might even hear the coffee pot clicking in the background. We started our conversation by asking Sam what sort of thing he had done when he worked for the Coast and Geodetic Survey on that first trip to Alaska.
I made a reconnaissance trip to the coast of near the Eagle. I walked all the way near the Eagle, and came on a canoe down the river to Circle, and landed in Circle October. And then I walked from Circle over here. There was no chief highway yet. Walking, starting out on a 300-mile trip before, didn't seem like nothing. It was all right, so, you know, you didn't worry about it at all. It didn't seem formidable. I had one man with me, it was all. We had six horses. He sold the horses and Eagle. And I shipped the canoe on the Eagle that spring, you know, during the summer on the steamboat. So to have it come down the river, this was all planned out ahead, see? That was 1925. When we went through from here, we started right from here and walked, you see, and when we left Big Delta, we left in the Chalk Creek Flat, this side of the Tanana River, and took off to the woods. We never saw a living soul for 8 weeks. There was nobody in the country there. But game, just like African game deal, swarms of it up there, because there's been no market hunting up there, see, in that section.
What do you mean? What kind of game?
Moose, caribou, mountain sheep, bears, wolves, everything. Oh, brother, we was living right in amongst them, you know, swarms of them. Paid no attention to them. We shot one caribou. We'd been out about a month and was meat hungry, and we shot one caribou, and we eat it all up. But the meat was so poor that we didn't do that again. We got to the head of the good pasture in August, and we shot one mountain sheep, and that was lovely. And we eat that right down to his ankles. Then we didn't shoot nothing else. We went without meat for quite a spell. We didn't shoot nothing else, and we got to the Columbia Mooselet, Columbia Creek Mooselet. And there was up people, miners there. We hadn't contacted them yet. And we shot a moose. I shot a moose, small moose, on the Columbia Creek lick. And we had meat again. And we kept one hind quarter, and the rest of it we gave to the mining camp. Now, that Columbia Creek lick, there was a mining camp just about 35 men, about 15 miles from there, 10 or 15 miles. And they got their meat there at that lick. And they send a man out with a rifle to the lick. 2.5 hours later, they would send a man out with a horse. If that fella didn't have a moose, he never got to go to that lake again. They'd send another man there. because it was so sure that you get a wolf there, you know,
yeah.
When you go to that lick. And he didn't, play. He was out of luck, he didn't get the hunt again. And that was where they got their meat. And we gave the rest of the moose to them. And they came and got it with one of their horses. There was something else interesting about that, too. Oh, yes, those moose. It seemed to be an addiction with them, that soda water that come out of the ground there. Because they would stay away. They were afraid to come to them lakes, you know, even where there was no men, because the wolves were around them. The wolves stayed there, you know, just laying for them. So they'd come tearing into the lake, you know, very alert. And they'd get to the lake and they'd look all around real wild, you know. And then they'd start drinking this water. And they'd be gamped. And if you was standing behind them or in front of them, you see their sides
get wider and wider.
Wider as they drank this water, this soda water, you know. And before they get to the lake, they cross the creek with the most wonderful water in the world, cold and clear, you know, and pure as ever. They'd splash right through that and never even look at it, you know. And come to that lake and drink madly, and they'd drink just once and they were gone. They didn't dare stay there on account of the wolves. My partner, he got the life scared out of there one day. He walked right into a bunch of wolves laying up in the jack spruces, you know. He had his horses up back of that pack that was about half a mile wide, and a nice swale. Frost had touched a little bit, but he found this swale up there that the frost hadn't hit. And it was excellent horse feeding, so he put his horses in there. So one day he went up and he didn't want to go around this thicket. He walked into that spruces. He hadn't gone in there more than a couple of hundred feet, you know, and he ran right into the middle of a pack of wolves. They were laying down sleeping. And told me, he says, I was parted the brush to go through, and he says, there was a wolf laying down, feet crossed, his chin was on his feet, and he was looking me right in the face. And he says, I shot him. And then he says, one jumped and I shot him. And then he says, I kept on shooting. He says, whenever I see him, he says, they jumped over my head and they jumped all around me. He says, I thought I was done for. And he wouldn't go back in there. And I said, well, we'll go up and see. Not me, he says, I won't go in there again. So I said, I'll go in there. And I said, you show me where to go. So we went back there, and he was heavy gun, like he was very alert. He was the poorest shot in the world. He couldn't hit nothing. And I never mind if he shot a wolf in there. He had shot him close, all right, but he was an awful poor shot. So I went in there where he told me, sure enough, there was a dead wolf that shot right down through the head. And I went a little further, I found a bloody smooch on the spruce tree, and he only had another wolf shot right through here. And then there was shot right through here, one, yeah. And so I got the two of them together, and I dragged them out. They were big ones, too, wherever they were, big ones. I dragged them out, and then there was two or three trails, there were two trails that had blood on them. So he was hitting me with so many wolves, it seemed like he couldn't miss them, I guess. But I know we never found any other wolves. He wouldn't go in there at all. No, couldn't get him in there. He was scared of. Well, we was at Columbia Creek, and from there we went on down to Liberty Fork, where John Powers had a cache and some cabins there. The road goes through there now, but there was no road there in those days. And we went down there and camped in that, and John had left us some hay and oats there. And he also used his own judgment, and he left us some eggs and some lemons, which was just out of this world for us, you know, because we've been deprived of that stuff all summer. We're living on dehydrated stuff, you know, concentrated food and stuff like that, and pea soup and split peas and beans a lot, stuff that could be packed easily. Of course, we had hot cakes, but that them they'll forget. Them lemons, oh brother, that really went good. He left an enormous supply of them too, you know. And he didn't charge us anything for that. He was a good old guy, old John Powers. He was a mail carrier and a freighter. And his wife had bought that horse. Now, the road goes through Liberty Fork now.
and also goes within 9 miles of those Columbia moose licks, which I regret very much. But then we found other moose licks as we went along before we got to this Columbia lick. We found other moose licks that nobody knew anything about. And one of them was a cone. Where,
now, were these for hot springs too?
No, they were cold water. But they were full of soda. And the moose, they get addicted to that. It was a funny thing. I was awfully surprised about that, because this one that I found, we found running across the country, you know, looking at everything and climbing the mountains, was in a wooded valley on a creek and timbered, quite heavily timbered. So the valley was warmer than the ground was thawed. And the trees grew pretty large there, spruce trees. Most of the country was barren, you know, above timberline. The trees were pretty big on that creek, and we came to opposite the mouth of that creek on the other side of the main creek, and we got a good look right straight up. It was straight up there, and I just had a hunch there was something unusual up in that valley. Couldn't see it from there, and so we made a note, I'd go up there and take a look at that. So one day I did. I went up there and I found this other moose lick. And that the moose had knocked down the timber, they had pawed out the dirt around the roots. And the trees had fell over, and they laid crossways and every old which way, and they'd broke the limbs off a lot of them, and the bark where they'd climbed over them, you know. And this cone, this is about, the cone at the base is probably 150 feet deep. And it was 30 feet high. Pretty cone, sort of looked like volcanic stuff, you know. And then it was hollow on top, another cone to you know. And there was water in there, and it was about the level of the water was about 10 feet, no, about 3 feet from the top of the cone. And this was soda water. And the moose had it all pawed up all around there. And while I was there, there were some trees that were large and other trees had fallen over, and I climbed up in there and I sat, waiting to see a moose in there. I didn't have to wait very long. There was a couple little cows come tearing in there, you know, and they looked all around. They were scared, you know. They were very alert, and they run up that cone, and when they drank, they were standing with their tail end up in the air and almost on their head, you know. You see their sides expanding, you know, way out. And then they drink, and they come out of there, and they look all around, and they burp. Oh, brother, what a burp. A moose can burp, too. And they took off. Dead run. Get out of there. And then when the bull came in, right just before they left, they didn't pay no attention to him. Big bull. Beautiful set of antlers in the velvet. And he didn't go into the pool to drink. He licked the mud around the base of the cone and a little way from it. He was nervous, very nervous. And I wondered what was bothering him, you know. He didn't seem to me. He had to be afraid of anything than the size of him, you know. But he was nervous, and pretty soon he threw up his head, and away he went to on the dead run. That's the way they all moved around them springs. Every one of them, they just moved on the dead run when they come in and when they went out.
And they were perhaps the lift for the wolves.
Yeah. Well, I sat there a while longer and I saw what happened then. Two big wolves stole right into the middle of the clearing and their sides were sticking out. They had been feeding these.
Oh.
They weren't hungry in that time. Why, they didn't tackle the moose, I guess. Oh, they were monsters, you know. I guess they'd weighed 175-180 pounds apiece.
The wolves?
Yeah. So that was the way then things happened, you know, and boy, I'll tell you, that was interesting. Our horses wouldn't drink that water.
Didn't?
No, and we tried it, and it was bitter, awful bitter, you know. But their moose, they get addicted to it, and they feel like they didn't drink nothing else.
Well, then you went on up to Eagle and took your canoe
yeah.
on down the circle.
Mm-hmm.
Did anything unusual happen on that trip?
No, that was just a sort of a routine canoe trip. And there was no bad water. It was all Yukon River, you know, easy going. fairly stiff current, but we were going downstream, so that helped.
After you got down to Circle City, what was Circle City then like in 1970?
Well, it was just a bunch of old dilapidated log cabins with old
big empty trading boats. I understand that originally, before the turn of the century in 1890, it had been a good sized town.
2,000 people in it. But there was only about probably 50 people in town, 50 or so.
So then you came down to Central. On your way south,
that's the way to carry? Yeah, there was no road there, and there was an old man, 70 years old, had been up to hunting with the Fish Brothers up at the Circle, up at Mason River. And there was a man and a woman who had been invited to leave Dawson, and they had left, blue ticketed, I think they called it. And they were there, they were waiting for somebody to come through so they could walk to Fairbanks to them.
Oh.
You see, the airplane transportation, although Norway was flying in 1924 and 1925, it hadn't got going yet.
Norway hadn't really gotten the
airline
going.
No, he hadn't gotten going. He was flying with one airplane, you know, special trips mostly out of Fairbanks, you know. So there was no airplane service over the Cape of Walk. No road then. The old mail trail, dog team, and they'd taken horses over it in the winter. That was all. And, this man and a woman were waiting, and this old man, this hunter, he was 70 years old, I remember, and his name was Moffitt. The other two, I don't remember the name. They were waiting for somebody to come through so they could catch themselves to him, you know, and walk out. So that, those were the days where you didn't say no to anything like that, you know, so we agreed, yeah, we'd go along with us. Well, of course, it held us up. It's awful, you know, because this woman, oh, she suffered the horrors of everything, you know, on that trip. And we was nice to her, the Romans tried to help her all we could, but there was very little we could do for her, except lug her pack and so forth. The old man, I was a little bit weird about him, but he came right through. He didn't, he was an asset to me. He was a nice old guy. And he was pretty rugged. He
never had 300 miles, roughly, wasn't it?
162.
From the Central.
Yeah.
So for a woman, that was a hard...
Oh, yeah, and this was tough going, you know. Hard footing, see? There was about 4 inches of snow. And...
Well, actually, in October, there was that much snow.
Yeah. Second day of October, it was snowing when we came into Circle. We got about... we got pretty close to the ferry. And... a band of wolves had crossed the trail, and there were so many of them that the snow, the poison snow, was beaten down just as smooth as this floor here. And they'd only gone across. They'd never turned around and come back. There must have been 60, 70 wolves in that bunch. And they had just crossed recently because you could smell them. The air was heavy with their scent. And, of course, that terrified her. The old man, he took it all right, didn't bother him, and we wasn't worried. They were after moose, you know, and there was caribou all over everything in those days. So he didn't worry about that. And they had a T-model Ford road from Circle to Central, and to they could occasionally, when the ground froze, get over it with T-models, and even up to Milliquit, and over to Central Hot Springs. But it was only when the roads were dry and frozen hard that they could use that kind of vehicle. Mostly they used horses. Well, there was no incident then until we got to the 12-mile roadhouse. Stayed overnight at Central, and then we went on to the Miller House. And there was nothing of any interest happened there. We just kept right on going through. But the next night was down on Eagle Creek below Barron's old mine. And a very peculiar incident happened there at Barry's mine. Barry himself was not hospitable, you know. They didn't allow anybody to stay at their cabin or anything like that. Maybe probably there was a good reason for that, too. But they had a caretaker there, Jack McCoy. And coming down the mountain, I run into Donald McDonald. I knew him well from Anchorage, you know. He was locating the piece of highway up the side of the mountain. And we had to talk to him. Then we went on down to this cabin in McCoy. He's a pretty nice fellow. And he said, "Will you fellas come in?" And we hadn't told him about the woman in the party. He was talking, he was doing the talking. He had his street talk, you know. He hadn't seen anybody for a little while. And so we hadn't told him about the woman in the party. And of course, she hadn't got that yet. And he said, "I just killed two caribou." And he said, "I got to go up the creek and dress them off." And he had a great big butcher knife that long, you know, and he was covered with blood from head to foot. And he went to the door and opened the door, and there was a woman. And she saw this big knife and blood all over him, and she let out a whoop and passed out and fell flat. And McCoy said, "Oh my God, a woman." And he turned and run through the house and went out the back door. And we didn't see him anymore. We left before he come back. And we helped him get the woman up, you know, and bring her in. He was moaning, you know. And she showed water in her face. And she got her, and told her everything was all right. And then from there, the next night, we put in down the creek. We didn't have no place to stay. We just a whole log cabin, nothing in it. Nobody had been there. Wasn't even a stove in it, you know. And we stayed there that night. So we gave the cabin to this man and the woman, and we stayed out in the yard mostly, you know. In the wind blow, it was kind of miserable. The snow was melting, the creeks were getting a little bit high. So next day we started for the 12-mile roadhouse. That's why we really run into something. I had to use some diplomacy there. I went up to the house. I was ahead of the whole works. My partner, he was staying, he was a big husky man, a good man too, and he was staying behind helping this guy with a woman, you know, and she was having an awful time. I'd have given up long before she did. That's not been me.
Was she dressed for this long
time? No, she wasn't properly dressed, you know, footgear especially. And I went up to the house, and this man that was running the place, this 12-mile roadhouse, he was batty. He'd gone off his rocker a little bit, you know, being there all alone. And he didn't have much grub. There was a caribou laying right beside the door, all on some logs. And I took a look at that, and I see the salad right away, you know. And I made a mental note of that. And then he came out, and he come right up to me, and he put his face right in line, and he said, "I'm blind, and I'm sick, and I'm broke." And I knew him. I said, "Well, Steve," I said, "this is Sam." I said, "I got some more people coming up the creek," and I said, "we've all got money to pay our bill to live, and we want something to eat." He said, "Well, I can feed you applesauce and caribou meat and some bread, and that's all I can do." He said, "That's all I got, a little wise." And I said, "Well, you do the best you can for us." And I said, we'll help you. We'll cut you some wood, and we'll help you and all we can. We'll wash the dishes, and we'll take care of ourselves." I said, "And we'll pay you. You'll have some money then, and then you won't be broke." And I said, "You'll feel better." So I went in the house and looked the situation over, and he started cooking right away, you know, and he cheered him up. And I ran out and I intercepted the other fellows, you know, as they came up. And I told them, "Well," I said, "you handle this man with care." I said, "don't cross him in any way." And I said, "we'll have a police state night and we'll get something to eat. But," I said, "whatever you do," I said, "don't eat any meat. Don't touch that caribou meat." I said, "it's solid." And I said, "it'll be on the table, I know." So the banker was a little bit behind, so I went back, I went down to him and I told him the same thing, and he agreed that he would be very careful, you know. And the woman, the man got that first this time, because the banker was carrying packs for him and relaying them, you know. And the woman and the man, they treated him very carefully, you know, and they were welcomed. And the banker came up, and he was used to being a banker, you know, and Steve Randy run right up to him, told him the same story he told me, with his face just about that far apart. And the banker looked in with them cold blue eyes, and says, "Well, partner," he says, "you're in a hell of a fix." He says, "that's why you sleep tonight right under that tree." He said, "you ain't getting into that house." And you wouldn't let him in for about an hour, and I finally had to talk to Steve quite a bit, and I finally, Steve relented and let him come in the house. And then we had this big feed on the table, you know, boiled rice and some bread, and boy, it looked real good, and the meat smelled good, big platter of boiled meat, you know, caribou. And she was pushing the meat, and I said, "No, Steve, I'm stuck on caribou meat. I can't eat it anymore." And the others, they were looking at it, you know, and I shook my head at them every time they looked at me, and I didn't want to offend Steve, you know. He could probably kick it right out. And by golly, one of them reached over and he took a hunk of that and tasted it. "Boy," he says, "that's good. You better have some." So they all eat caribou meat that night. Next morning, they were feeling fine. We started out and they'd gone about a mile and they all got sick all at once. And from there, over the 12-mile summit, I logged all the packs. Instead of getting to the Face Creek Roadhouse, we got halfway there. Under the first trees on that 12-mile, and they had a face trick. And we camped there that night, and boy, if I didn't have a time taking care of those people. We didn't have no grub, and we figured on making the roadhouse, you know. We didn't have no grub. So I had to go out and shoot some ptarmigan and shoot spruce hens to feed them. And the next day, the next morning, they were still sick, so I rushed on down to the Face Creek Roadhouse and told the man who was coming. I told him I wanted a can of pepper and some sugar. And I got some, he gave me a can of pepper and some sugar. I went back and I mixed the pepper and sugar together and I started feeding them that until their eyes got bloodshot. And that done it. That fixed them up. And I got them down at the roadhouse then. And they were feeling all right then.
Well, Sam and his traveling companions made it on into Fairbanks safely. As a result of Sam's notes on the game in the area between Delta and Eagle, the United States became more concerned with wildlife conservation in Alaska, and he returned as a wildlife agent for the Alaska Game Commission. In a future program, Sam will tell about his experiences as a bush pilot during the first years in Alaskan aviation. But the next broadcast of the Sourdough Speak will turn to the woman's side of life in Fairbanks. Claire Russ, well-known pioneer, will tell some unusual stories about her experiences and the people she knew in Fairbanks. Claire came here as a girl in 1909, and she'll tell about her arrival by boat and the early town of Chena and the many kinds of people who lived here. This is Neville Jacobs inviting you to be with us in our next broadcast of A Sourdough Speak.
You have been listening to The Sourdough Speak, a series of discussions about the history and development of interior Alaska in taped interviews with pioneer Alaskans. The Sourdough Speak was produced by Alaska Communication Arts in conjunction with the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services. Mm-hmm.